Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Sean Martin and Brendan Porath are back to recap an unbelievable Open Championship. We talk Tiger Surge on Sunday, Xander Schauffele, Ricky Fowler, and much more. First, I'd like to thank our Open Championship sponsor, Greater Than. It's a healthy and delicious alternative to your traditional sports drink, and it packs two times the electrolytes with half the sugars of its big brand competitors. Greater Than introduced a new trial pack, which you can get on drinkgt.com. It gives you the chance to try each of their three flavors and decide which one you like the best. Give it a shot. It's my favorite non-alcoholic refreshment on the golf course. Now here's Brendan and Sean.
The fried egg requires a different technique. What you need to do is actually square the face so it'll dig down underneath that bad lie and propel that ball right out onto the green.
Here's the thing. Playing out of a buried lie in a bunker is completely different than playing out of a nice, clean lie in a greenside bunker.
You need to be aggressive on any shot, whether it's sitting cleanly or it's a fried egg.
Well, we've all faced it, the dreaded fried egg. It's not to be feared, though. It's actually a pretty easy shot to hit.
I just think the Xander thing is more true today than it was when you asked it before the player.
Is Xander overrated or underrated?
It's more true today than it was before the player.
So you're doubling down on him being overrated.
I'm not doubling it out. This was a nuanced take. It wasn't that stinks.
The general ignoramus public, he's vastly underrated. But to the in the know golf audience, I'm just tired of being like, oh, I'm woke because I know who Xander is. Like, we all know who Xander is. If you follow golf and don't know who Xander is, you're doing it wrong.
Yes. It's more true today than it was the players. The question was, or our point, our response was, not that he sucks at golf or he wasn't going to win or this couldn't happen. It was that it was like this hipster crowd saying, you know what? I think...
I'm so woke. I know who Xander is. No, you're not woke. He's a good player. You should know who he is.
John keeps interrupting me.
Sorry.
It was like people saying, you know what? I think Brooks Koepka, like last year, I think Brooks Koepka's good at golf. He's my dark horse pick. Like, no, it's not dark horse. It's like, that's the thing. Xander got too overrated with the hipster crowd. It's just like, it's a ubiquitous take. He's good at golf. We know he's good at golf. I hope he does well. I would have been great. I would have been happy if he won today. That's fine.
Amen.
But it's more true that what we were saying then is more true today than it was than it was even before the players. Good on him for his runner-up finish. That was great. But I mean, it only reaffirms, like, now everybody's like, Xander, man, he's like, I know golf. There's this guy with like kind of a funny name, man. I know golf. And you hear about Xander Schauffele? You hear that name before? That's my guy. So that's the whole crew that it got. That's the whole genesis of this overrated thing.
So
the problem is the pod is going to start in the middle of this rant somewhere that makes us both look like idiots again.
No, I'm gonna give you guys the full runway here. Where does Xander rank among the young players in the game? Let's just say 25 and younger.
I mean, you still got to put Spieth and JT ahead of him.
Yeah. Rahm?
How young are we going? Like Cole Hammer?
Have to be professional.
There was an over-under better career in majors, Rahm or Xander, somewhere in the Twitter replies. And I lean Rahm. Lean Rahm in that sense.
That's a question. I mean, come on. I think we're getting a little carried away.
But yeah, if Brendan and I don't realize that Xander Schauffele is good at golf, then we're both idiots and should be immediately fired from our jobs.
No. Yeah, I just... where do you do it? Andy, you seem to have preconceived thoughts on this before you asked it.
So I think, like, you know, 2 years ago, you would say there was, like, Spieth, JT, and Berger.
right? And I think he's moved into...
He's ahead of Berger.
I'd put him ahead of Berger, for sure. Yeah, I think,
for sure.
I think with Americans, I mean, obviously you got some young guys like DeChambeau and Aaron Wise that are just getting their kind of footing on the PGA Tour. But, you know, DeChambeau and Xander have essentially been pros, you know, for the same amount of time. And, you know, on the PGA Tour for the same amount of time, both have two wins. But I think the thing that sticks out with Xander is, like, if you look at where he's gained all of his world ranking points, they're like the biggest events of the PGA Tour schedule. I mean, he gets them in the majors. He gets them in WGCs. Like, you know, he had a really good finish at Riviera. Like, you know, it's what impresses me is it seems like his game rises to another level when it's a stage with the best players in the world. You know, three.
Totally. I mean, his top tens this year are Riviera, the majors, and the players.
Yeah, like T2nd at the players, T2nd at the Open. You know, first of the Tour Championship, he's got three top sixes in majors and a T2nd at the players, and he's played in six of them. You know, four top six finishes in the five biggest events of the year. Pretty impressive.
Your cutoff was 25 years old. Is that what the question was?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where you cut it off. I don't know what you. I think in today's day and age, 25 is probably the young, right?
Yeah. Post 25, you're like already entering your prime, right? I mean,
It's interesting. I think the prime of a golfer has changed from it used to be, you know, 30 to 40 to now it's 25 to 35, really.
Totally. I mean, Patrick Rogers, 10 years ago, Patrick Rogers' career would be very far ahead of the curve. And now it's like he doesn't even get mentioned with his boys because they've done so much. But I mean, he's like 25, he's had a tour card for a couple of years. Like that, 10 years ago, that was really, really good.
The thing with Schauffele is, I think Rahm, I'd still give the edge to Rahm over Schauffele. But I mean, the way he hits the ball, he's so good tee to green. The way he drives it, like he drove it so well all week. He's just got so much confidence, and I think he's underrated because he played at San Diego State. Nobody really knew him, but I mean, he made it to the finals of the Western Am. I mean, that's a pedigree event. I think he's a stud. I mean, obviously he's a stud, but I think he's definitely going to win at least one major. I don't know. We'll see. Who gets more majors, Rick or Schauffele?
Wow. Man.
Schauffele just because of like the year's advantage and just less scar tissue. And I don't know, man.
So
Ricky's hard to back right now. He either gets one and then it's like, this is great. You know, it's kind of, I'm done. I made my career achievement, or maybe like the worst cliche in sports, the floodgates open. So I don't know. It's hard to predict with Rick.
Yeah. I mean, everyone goes back to the, you know, Phil was what, 34 when he won his first major. I think Hogan was 34. You can have a fruitful career. I don't know. There's so many different, like, the thing I love about baseball that they do is, like, they'll take a guy's stats and they find comparable players based on their, like, career paths from that point forward, and they'll compare, like, all right, every guy who was hitting 250 by his age 25 season with 15 homers, like, this is the average of what his career looks like. And I don't feel like we do that well in golf. We just, like, some guy has a great season. Oh, his progression is going to be linear. Like, you know, Andy, you and I see an amateur golf of like some guy dominates in amateur golf, and you're like, oh, he's obviously going to be a great pro. And it's like, no, I think some guys actually had the best years of their career, like in amateur golf, unfortunately, and earned nothing for it. And it's just, I don't know, career progression is so hard. We get so spoiled by these guys. Like, we think everyone's going to have a 20-year great career when, like, it's so hard in this game to have even 10 years of just great play. There's just so many things that happen. Like, I always look at like Keegan. Now, granted, Keegan, I mean, the anchoring band obviously really hurt his career, but like Keegan, 2011 rookie year, wins twice, including a major. Like, we all think, oh my gosh, where's this guy gonna, you know, he went to St. John's, a small school, and we all think of like he's gonna be unstoppable, but it didn't pan out. And now I'm not saying that Xander's gonna go through the same thing, but it's just like there's so many variables that you just never know what's gonna happen.
Yeah, I mean, well, Molinari is a perfect example of that career progression, you know? This is his moment, and it's all because, like, he was always an elite ball striker, but, you know, he shored up his short game in putting, and, I mean, he didn't make a bogey the last two rounds, and, you know, 5 years ago, that would never have happened.
Yeah.
But he keeps working better, and I think that's at all levels of golf. Like, I think one of the things about golf, like, you see it playing junior golf, like you see these kids that are unbelievable at age 15. But the hardest thing in golf is to get better once you're at 0, +2, +3 handicap. Like, getting better is becomes way more difficult the better you get.
Sure. I would just say
this is a good transition to talk about the U.S. Junior. I'm just kidding.
I was about to say, we're like minutes in here. Got a good like 10 minutes on Shoffley. Tiger just had like the biggest moment in golf, their biggest contention in 5 years. Got a good 10 minutes on Shoffley, a mention of Keegan Bradley, Patrick Rogers, Cole Hammer. We haven't talked about Tiger or Molinari yet. It's just, this is like exactly how it should be.
So
right on point.
So you're bringing us back to the general here, Brendan. What was your takeaway from you know, the Open? What did you love today, or what did you think?
Well, my favorite moment, I think, was the absurdity of that woman keeping her child in that stroller and shuffling back. I mean, that woman should be ejected from the country. She should be thrown in prison. She should be, like, she was steadfast, refused to move. The guy was over his ball at address, and the kid started chirping again, and she just stood there. He backed off, and then she just stood there. Like, wouldn't you scurry into the crowd in shame and hide your face?
You know, I'm glad you circled the wagons to talk about a child in the crowd. You know?
I mean, that was my favorite moment. It was just added a wrinkle of absurdity to a, like, to be in all seriousness. I think, you know, since I've been doing this, one of the maybe the top day at a major championship. Yeah, I think 2011 Masters is up there. 2013 Masters was bonkers, like the whole weekend. You know, Adam Scott, Angel Cabrera aren't the names that we got today. And obviously, I don't know, that whole 2013 year was great. I think this is certainly 1A or 1B, and I think there's just too much to choose from. I guess that's where I'd go, is this the best, kind of the most enjoyable and manic and eventful final round of a major for you guys?
Real quick, I want to go back to the kid in the stroller. I have a 2-year-old, and I don't understand how anyone brings a child under the age of 13 to a golf event. It blows my mind. As far as manic, I think 2011 Masters is up there. But it's definitely up there, I think.
Yeah. I mean, leaderboard wise with like the superstars, we haven't seen that in a really long time where legitimately on Sunday you had, you know, probably the three biggest names in golf right now, Spieth, Rory, and Tiger, all with like a legit shot to win. You know, and then
one of my favorite moments was like, for whatever reason, I flipped out onto the leaderboard online and like I just opened it real quick. It was before they had showed Rory's eagle putt, and or maybe my DVR, I at some point ended up 30 seconds behind, and it showed Rory at the top at 6 under. I was like, wait, what the hell? Wait, where? Like, because you hadn't seen him in so long, and he just wasn't like part of the story. And I flipped up in the leaderboard. I was like, what the hell? Rory McIlroy? He was at the very top because he had just made, you know, joined the lead most recent. And then all of a sudden they showed his eagle. And it just like took what already was a crazy day to like another level. And I mean, anytime you get Rory joining the lead in the last, like, what I guess it was five holes of major championship, that's going to be the biggest story of the day. But this was like way down, you know, in the middle of the pack, 3, 4, 5. That was amazing. I looked at the board. I was like, that can't be right. Rory's not in first. And then his eagle putt came on the TV, you know, 30 seconds later, and I couldn't believe it. I think it was just, there's too much to choose from.
To me, the Open Championship has supplanted the Masters as the best event of the year.
Wow.
3 years in a row, it's been the best. And then, you know, if you look back, like Will Knights wrote an article about like the last 10, and you read through them, and it's just like, oh my God, every year, pretty much. I mean, you Sink and Watson, you know, they're every single year is seemingly a great championship. You know, when was the last time that you were disappointed with the Open Championship?
Right.
Yeah.
So why do you think that is? I mean, aside from obvious things like venue.
I mean, I think so much of it is links golf because it allows so many different varieties of play to compete. I mean, Watson's not competing if it's not a links course. Greg Norman's not challenging a Birkdale if it's not a links course. I think so much of it is that it is a links course.
But we keep getting the best names at the top of leaderboard out of 156.
I'm trying to make my point. I think Andy will agree here that when it's firm and fast, and yeah, the greens were soft, but the fairways were not this week. When it's firm and fast and windy, you got to control your trage. And so that brings out the best players. Yeah. You know, it's one thing to hit a 8-iron 150 and stick it. It's another thing to hit like a, you know, little punch 7-iron baby cut back into the wind. Patrick Reed had a great quote earlier in the week of like, the fairways were so firm that, let's say you were trying to hit a 6-iron and you caught it a groove low, it was actually going to go like 20 yards farther because the trajectory was lower and the spin was less. And so like that small little mishit was going to be punished exponentially. So I think you just have to control your trage, strike your ball well when conditions are firm and fast and when you're running it on the ground.
Yeah, I agree. I think what it is that players all of a sudden have to think about where they're going to land the ball. And that's a lot different than, hey, it's 152. You know, and it's, yeah. Is it like the yardages at an Open? I mean, they don't mean anything. 152 could be a wedge that you land 120 or like, you know, a chip 8-iron that you land 120 and let roll in. It could be, you know, it could be a number of shots. You could hit all these different shots. The trajectory matters. The spin matters. Like, and I think that brings art to the game. It's not as scientific. It's much more feel oriented. And I think it also brings all the skills to the forefront. And that's what, you know, great golf courses do is it makes players have to hit all the great shots. Like when you go to a great golf course, you generally hit every club in your bag, you know? And I think that's kind of the essence of why the Open has done this is that it allows everybody to play their own game, but it also, you know, to succeed, you have to hit all the shots.
So do you not need to think about where it's going to land at Augusta or a US Open venue? I mean, I'm not.
You do, but I don't think it's to the same degree, you know? Yeah. I think Augusta, you know, the tree planting has taken away a little bit from that golf course. That golf course is, you know, just like it was built after the old course. You know, so that's, I mean, but they've lost some of the, you know, the essence of that over the years. But at the same time, I mean, this is nothing against Augusta. I just think that the Open, in my mind, has become the best event of the year.
I thought Will Gray from Golf Channel had a great tweet about that. He's like, USGA has every, like, technology and piece of equipment at their disposal and still get out of their own way. But the RNA just like puts a sign in the ground pointing you to the first tee, and it's the best tournament ever. Like, they just, I don't know.
In the defense of the USGA, I think that the media actually goes into the US Open and like looking for things that the USGA is going to screw up, you know?
Right.
Like if the USGA had the greens as soft as what the RNA had them this week, people would be throwing like a shit fit about it.
Good point. That's a good point.
But would they if like 8 under won? I think 5 to 10 under is a great winning score.
Yeah, I agree, but I think people would still do that. Like, you know, like a perfect example is people would complain about how thin the rough was. Yeah. And like, I thought that was absolutely like that fescue was so perfect because you saw unbelievable recovery shots from that stuff. But then you also saw Tiger try and do too much from it. And that's what killed him in the middle of the round. That's what cost Tiger. That like thin fescue cost Tiger a shot at winning.
Yeah. Euphemism of tugging the shaft. Yeah, it was always kind of parental advisory. Kept using that phrase. That's literally what cost him the championship in the middle of the. That's a great point though about the different universes the organizations have to work in, especially with those green, like those soft greens first couple of days. I don't know. The bar. I don't know if the bar is higher for the USGA or they've lost the luxury of having, you know, margin for error or I don't know.
I think it's more they've lost the trust. It's like, you know, if a kid like constantly, you know, abuses the trust of a relationship, the kid's got a shorter leash, you know, from whoever it is, you know, whether it's their parents. But I think the USGA has like, you know, they've had so many problems over the years, and in the RNA on the opposite end of the spectrum has never really done anything that have, you know, violated the trust.
The biggest thing was what, 2015, St. Andrews and the winds. They said they let the greens get too fast, so they had to wipe out a whole day of play because of whatever. It's at the 11th green, it's too exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So they were just, I mean, that's, I think that's like the biggest screw, you know, the most criticism they received in the last, you know, 8 years or so.
How about they put Spieth on the clock?
I didn't get that. I didn't know that until I saw him talking about it. He said that was a turning point in his championship. I mean, I don't know. I don't think he was trying to blame someone else, but he's like that threw me off. That really like changed the way I played. What would they come in at? Like 340?
I think it was like 415 today.
Oh, they were that long?
Yeah. It was a little longer.
At 2 or something. Okay.
But you know, they're actually enforcing the rules. If the USGA did that to a leader, people would go nuts.
Yeah, that's true.
Didn't they? I thought they put the final group on the clock this year. No.
USGA? Yeah, they did. Today, I think.
No, I mean at the U.S. Open.
Oh, sure. U.S. Oh, I think they did. Right.
I think they did. Everyone's on the clock. They're all slow. Just kidding.
I don't know. That pace of play was also one of the most refreshing things. Like, remember.
Well, here's the thing. I tweeted this at Colonial, and all these Scots, well, one Scot, was coming at me. And I was like, people underestimate how much the walk from green to tee affects pace of play. Like, Colonial is super walkable. I mean, green's right off of tees. Now, granted, it feels a little bit smaller. It's like 120, I think. But, like, guys are getting around in four, under four on the weekend, and so same with links golf. I think people underestimate the walk from tee to green, and then also if you're not taking a ton of drops, there's not a lot of hazards obviously on links golf, so you're not getting a ton of rulings. So I think those are two things that people underestimate about pace of play.
Reith was talking about how Xander kept getting bugs on his ball.
Yeah.
And then what else? They had a couple of rulings and thought that was the only time. So like he said, it was the fastest round he thought he really ever played, and he was surprised to be on the clock.
He had that drop on what hole was it on the front nine? It was eerily reminiscent of last year.
Par five, right?
Yeah, six.
Yeah, six. Hogan's Alley.
How great is that hole?
Good hole.
Those guys made double and bogey on that hole.
The Tiger put it on the front edge of the green.
Mm-hmm. It's what did you guys think of Carnoustie?
I think Paul Casey put it the best. He said, it's not sexy, but it's good.
Yeah.
So, like, you can't see the water from the course. But so it's just, it is kind of, you know, it doesn't have the mystique of St. Andrews and have the water views of some other courses, but it's just, It is. It's good. It's so well bunkered. And Tiger kind of called it early in the week of like, some guys are talking about like, oh, I'm going to hit driver everywhere and bomb it over the bunkers. And Tiger was like, you can't really do that here. It's too well bunkered. And it really, it is. It's very well bunkered. I think guys who tried to take that approach because it was so firm and fast got ejected. And, you know, it's some of the toughest pop bunkers. They're so small here. Some of the faces are like 6 feet deep that pop bunkers are almost a one-stroke penalty here. And so, I don't know. I think it was great. The bunkering, I mean, you had bunkers coming into the middle of the fairways. You didn't just have bunkers lining the sides of the fairways. And so, really, if you wanted to have the best angle in, you had to challenge the bunkers, which, I mean, that's width and angles 101 right there.
Yes, that's, I think, like, it reminds me kind of Chicago golf in a way of, like, where it's, like, it's not a dramatic sight. Pretty flat. Yep. Nothing really special in the architecture. You look at it and you're like, why can't more golf courses be this simple and this good? You know?
Yeah. I think I tweeted after you posted that drone photo of Chicago golf club. I'm like, this place is dead flat. Like, why can't we do this more often? This would be so cheap to build.
Tiger was saying he thought it's much more, undulating than Hoylake. Cause they were asking him about, you know, if he would do the Hoylake strategy, but it's like, well, you got a lot more bumps and humps and hills there, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe Hoylake extremely flat.
Those bunkers are no joke there. I mean,
no.
How about that shot Tiger hit, on 10?
Tiger looked back there. That was old school Tiger. That was like, I don't know. I mean, I think I heard multiple people say, like, oh, this is over. He's going to win this thing after he hit that shot.
That's what I thought. Like, in my head, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Game over.
The spots where the first four or five spots where, like, things would go backwards or come undone didn't happen. Or you got used to that kind of in 2013. Just like a couple early bogeys. But here he like saved par, whether it was eight. I think it was eight. He got up and down from a pot bunker for par. The one time, like his par saving putt just like hung on the edge of the cup and like fell in. Normally that would just kind of stay. Not normally, but you know, in recent years. Like it, and then that recovery out of the bunker. It just felt like he was the spots where like he would drop a shot, like it just felt like those weren't happening. It, combined with Saturday's tee shot on 18, kind of dancing on the edge of the burn there, that when he yanked that iron, two iron, it just felt like it was kind of coming together and it was his week. And then the bogeys very much happened a couple holes later.
That double bogey on, I mean, it was amazing to watch. And I think I get amazed by this every like major where you're really watching and you're really engaged in the tournament is like, you just realize how small the margin of error is of like Molinari. Like he just didn't make mistakes. And then you look at Tiger, like that one mistake, like the flop shot by just not playing a little safer and giving himself a chance, making that double bogey. You know, Molinari's wedge shot would have been a lot more difficult with Tiger in there tight if he didn't have that one shot lead or two shot lead.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And I think that's something that's you look at Rory missed a short putt on Saturday on 12, and then he missed a short putt again today. And those two putts, that's like, you know, that's the difference between him being in a playoff and being in second.
Yeah, there were a couple with Rory that just what do you have, two bogeys in the first five holes today, 18 yesterday, where he kind of just he couldn't get up and down. There's so many, like you said, like so many very minuscule things that, you know, end up being a big difference and put miles between the top of the leaderboard and wherever you fall.
Yeah, I feel like Tiger would have made that birdie putt on 18 had it been, you know, a different situation.
Yeah, I think he saw whatever Molinari stuff it a minute later and was just like, oh, whatever.
So Andrew had a good question. Andrew K, I think. Based on this week, which is the one player you're buying stock, and which one are you selling?
Cool. I didn't own any Tiger stock, so I guess Tiger? Maybe Xander?
Is what you're buying?
Yeah.
Selling Ricky, buying. I mean, I don't know. Buying Tiger, I guess. Right?
I mean, long term buying. Actually, Xander's a better long term investment. Buying Xander, if I didn't own her already.
I'm buying Tony Finau. Three straight top tens in majors. Could be four. And Bell Reef probably is going to fit him well. It's going to be nice and doughboy soft out there. And then who am I selling?
Rom, DJ, JT. I'm trying to think who missed a cut. I mean, a lot of good guys, obviously. Not worth selling, but I'm just saying.
I think I'd probably sell him Rick.
One player is tough.
Rick?
Yeah. Rick only has, like, you talk about, like, these trajectories. Ricky doesn't have a lot of wins.
Yeah, and 73, 73 yesterday was really disappointing. Started in the mix, could have made a move, was playing easy. It was harder in the afternoon, but, I mean, still, the 73 yesterday was just, it wasn't good.
What's his last win? Honda? No. Was it last year's Honda?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah, last year's Honda. It's just,
I don't know. It's like, it's not easy to be as like consistently good as he is. But I mean, it's easier than winning. He doesn't win as much as his peer.
It is a tough one. It's like the Charles Howell argument.
Yeah.
I just don't understand why either he doesn't win as much. He's kind of like Paul Casey in a way. You know?
Yeah, and I think like whether it's subconscious or not, like the demands on him are greater because he's so exposed. There's so much exposure, whether we're doing it consciously or not. Because he's in, you know, he pops up in every commercial break of every telecast, whether it's, you know, Mercedes or mortgages or insurance or whatever it is. And like his popularity with just kind of the clickbait world, you know, like he does something on Instagram and it's immediately a post, whereas a lot of guys with more wins don't, you know, do something and it's not the subject of some article. I think like, the demands on him are higher and the disappointments are more conspicuous because of that exposure, you know, off the golf course. I know that's not exactly a new take, but I think it is where we are when you're talking about, you know, a Paul Casey or someone like that. It just is. The disappointments are more conspicuous.
Yeah, I liked the Masters quote when he kind of said, you know, this was the first one I really felt like I should have won. I feel ready to win. I thought maybe that would bring maybe a harder edge to him. I think, the hard part, too, like, Ricky's content, which I think is fine. Like, we want these guys to, like, always be mad whenever they don't win, and we want them to be, you know, just fiery. And you can't do that in this game because you win so little. But then we harp on them when they like seem content, which I think Ricky does. Like you want to just be more fired up. I don't know, but he's really good by most metrics, except for wins.
It's this whole thing is like, is winning overrated? Because if a consistency is, you know, more important than winning, he's like one of the 10 best players of, you know, in the world. But if it's strictly based off winning, he isn't.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at his results. And so he finished runner up at the Masters. And since then, he's missed one cut. And besides that missed cut, his worst finish is 21st. I mean, literally like second, T21, MC, T14, T8, T20, 12th, and 6th. And then I think he finished like 28th this week. Like, That's hard to do.
To me,
but then I wonder if there's like that. So like Ricky can just kind of coast and play really good golf, and Ricky's normal golf is really good. But you need to have that like spike of where you're really like. So if you're like your strokes gain total, you know, some guys are pretty flat line. Some guys have spikes, peaks and valleys, and their peaks get them wins and their valleys get them missed cuts. But we'd rather see that in a sense. See the wins and the missed cuts and see the guys kind of flatline. Like Ricky just plays well every event. He's kind of got his range, whereas the environment favors those guys who will peak and get the wins even if they miss the cuts afterwards.
Yeah.
There's something you said for just playing a ton of good golf.
It is interesting because I think society values the, you know, win twice in a year, miss 10 cuts over.
Yeah.
You know, missing three cuts, having tons of top tens, and not winning. You know,
yeah, totally.
And I don't know what's better.
Well, the market definitely, I don't know, wants whatever Ricky's selling. I guess whether he, I don't know. I think like, but our little corner of the world, golf nerds and people who follow this, you know. I guess we can have reasonable debates about it, but you know, Skip, what did Skip Bayless say? Ricky's too short, like physically too small to win.
Yeah. He's not tall enough.
The take artist, you know, yeah.
So, is Justin Rose the best player in the world?
Yeah. I think, I was going to say Dustin, but Dustin missed the cut this week.
The thing that kind of struck me was how really like unsurprising it was to see him.
Yeah.
As soon as he made that putt on Friday to make the cut on the number, it was like, oh, well, like he's going to finish in the top 20, top 10 maybe. And then like, it just felt natural and expected for him to shoot that 64 on the round of the day on Saturday. And then, you know, goes under par again today. And I think that what struck me was just how natural and automatic it felt.
So yeah, I think too, the thing with Rose, he was an amazing ball striker for so long, right? But he couldn't putt.
Yeah.
And then his putting improvement has been huge this year. And so basically you're taking a guy who was a perfect player, except for the one club in his bag. And now he's really good with that, so he's basically a perfect player right now.
You know, I heard it's because he stopped wearing the sunglasses. He can read the greens better.
I didn't even think
that. I can't tell. That feels like it could be a real take, but I just can't tell.
No, he started to stop wearing the sunglasses last fall in the FedEx Cup.
Actually, you know what? That's right. I remember at Tour Championship, someone asked him, and I was in the interview, and he said that if he starts the week with the sunglasses on, he would wear them throughout the week. So like, I think one day it was cloudy and he was wearing them and someone was like, why are you wearing sunglasses? It's cloudy out. He's like, well, for consistency with my reads, if I start the week with the sunglasses on, I finish the week. So now he's just no sunglasses.
He does aim point, right? Is that right?
He does the claw. I don't know about aim point.
I think I've seen him do that. I don't know.
You know, 23 starts since last year's Northern Trust, 4 wins. And 18 top tens.
It's hard to beat a guy who hits it really, really good and now putts really, really good.
Less majors than Brooks Koepka.
Less majors than Brooks Koepka, though. This is like the whole debate.
Yeah.
You know, less wins than Dustin, probably, I think.
I would say, I think, maybe not. I'd say Jason Day has had like the most Tiger-like run of the last 5 years. Maybe DJ when he won 3 starts in a row. But like, you know.
Jason Day's the only guy that sustained it for 18 months.
Yeah.
You know, like over a year of sustained dominance. You know, like there was like no question who the best player in golf was during Jason Day's run. You know?
He's got one major PGA at Whistling Straits.
Saying like about Rose is I feel like there's not a lot that's going to be changing his life. Like Jason's wife is pregnant. They have another kid. He wants to spend a lot of time with his family, which I think is great. Oh. But like, you're adding another kid and things like that. There's no variables in Justin Rose's life, right? Like, he's married, he has his kids, and now it's all about his game. And I don't know. I just don't see a lot changing with Justin Rose, I guess. Like, I feel like he's just going to keep this up.
How old is he?
I think he's 37.
Late 30s. Yeah. Well, he was, what, 18 in the 98 Open when he finished fourth, so he's 38,
37. Huh. I mean, just talking about, like, the primes lasting, you know, being shorter. I don't know. Rose, although he's... Rose has a game that doesn't feel violent, although he's got the back witch doctor.
Yeah, but that was the thing. So last year at Birkdale, I asked him, because I'd heard they'd been making swing changes for the back. And, I mean, that's one reason he's playing so much better, is the back is so much better, and they've changed a lot in his swing. Not stuff that's visible to, like, the naked eye, but they've changed stuff in his swing to alleviate the back pain, and that's one reason he's playing so well, is because they've gotten the back in a good place.
I'm surprised one of Foley's students has back problems.
You know, I think with Rose, I think we talked about progression earlier in the pod.
Yeah.
He was like a short hitter, and now he's one of the longest.
Yeah.
Nobody successfully does that.
I remember at the Masters when he and Sergio were going back and forth, they were both hitting at like 330 with regularity on that Sunday. You know, not 330 every time, but they were both just plenty long enough. I just couldn't, like, everybody. It was just crazy. Rose, you just think of as kind of like this lanky ball striker. He's older, and he's just like striping irons. But yeah, like you said, he's playing long enough.
One way that Justin Rose could stay a little bit more healthy is to stay hydrated. It's good for your back. It's good for your entire body. The best way to stay hydrated on the golf course is Greater Than. Check out Greater Than on drinkgt.com and use the promo code THEFRIEDEGG for 20% off your order. If you want to give it a shot before you dive into a full case, check out their new trial pack where you can taste each of their three flavors for a nice low price. That's drinkgt.com.
I might be selling Sergio.
Yeah, that's good.
That might be my sell, actually.
I mean, yeah, talking about variables, I mean, he got married and had a child in not that long a time span.
Well, that's kind of what I was talking about with Ricky earlier. It's like, I don't know, you spend your entire life trying to get this one thing, and you get it. And that, like that just has to be a sense of accomplishment. Like, you know, you build a company and some people... you know, build a company and sell it for enough money to, you know, retire 100 times over. And that's what they do. And they just hang out and live the life. And others want to build another company and sell another one for a couple hundred, you know, times over, you know, more money than they will ever need. I think, like, you can have that effect with winning a major. Sergio spent 20 years in the spotlight and coming close to winning majors, and he finally got it. And I guess, you know, I'm not saying he like doesn't care anymore, but whether it's deliberate or not, I mean, that could have an effect where you're just like, wow, I just achieved, you know, everything that I've been building towards, and that's eluded me for so long. And maybe some, you know, and I wonder about that with Ricky. That's kind of what I was getting at earlier. I don't know. I think Sergio's too talented to never contend at a major again or not win a couple more, but I think maybe that's what he's going through.
Yeah. I kind of think the same thing with Sergio. I think it's almost like he needed, like he's on like a little bit of a golf break, and that's perfectly fine. You know, like when entrepreneurs sell their, you know, companies, a lot of times they take a couple year break, you know?
Yeah. Like, I definitely think Sergio's there. And it's understandable after decades of pursuing a major and then also pursuing marriage and a family.
Mm-hmm. That's the unique thing, I think, with golf more so than like a lot of other sports is like, you know, I don't think your body decays, but your these careers are so much longer. You know, Sergio has been, you know, in the spotlight since he was 17 years old.
Yeah.
And now he's, what, 38, 39?
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, Kobe retired at, what, 37?
Sounds right.
So, like, he's at a point where most athletes are retiring. You know, and with golf, he's got 10 more years. And it takes like such a special like drive for somebody to keep going. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's a tricky thing because I think after he won that major, I thought it was going to open the floodgates. And it's like, God, this guy's been so close so many times. And and I think it's one of those things where it could go either way. And it went the other way at this point.
It also coinciding with him getting married and having kids was unexpected. That's just a lot. I mean, achieving the thing of your life and then also achieving so many things in your personal life happening at the same time. I mean, can have that kind of effect. I don't know. I was disappointed. Can we just talk about like how it's so dumb to think like a major 10 years ago would have any impact on this week? Like the fact that he came close to Carnoustie in, you know, 2007, we put way too much weight in that kind of stuff. So I think like while it felt disappointing, he didn't, you know, whatever, he wasn't battling down the stretch like he was 10 years ago. I just think like that storyline gets so overblown. Like every time we come to a new play, you know, in the three rotating majors, we come back to a place. It's like, I don't know. People weren't picking Paul Laurie this week. We put way too much weight in that this week.
Yeah, but you guys have 10 top 10s in the Open.
Yeah.
I understand that, but people were just citing that 2007 one, like, oh, he played well at Carnoustie. That had no bearing on how he's playing right now and
I got fooled by that. You know, I'm the idiot that picked Sergio.
It wasn't a bad pick. I mean, it's not like a crazy pick.
So when I play like really good golf courses, I find myself getting sad at the end of the round, like on like the 15th hole, like on the green, I'll be just like kind of like in devastation knowing that the round's ending. And today during the golf tournament, I'm like, maybe like the back nine, the leaders got to the back nine. I all of a sudden got really sad because I looked at the PGA Tour schedule and saw Glen Abbey, Firestone, Bell Reef. Like,
it's really,
I want you guys to get me like, how can I get excited about the PGA? Because like it might be the all-time lowest level of excitement for a major championship I've ever had in my life.
I'm excited because my wife's brother is getting married that week, so we're running a beach house for the week in Pensacola. I am sad to not see Brendan and Kyle and KVD there, but I am excited for the vacation.
I like when you talk about your feelings on this podcast, Andy. Last time said that day at Shinnecock was the worst day of your life. Wasn't that the U.S. Open, like, post-game? You're like, Saturday might have been the worst day of my life. Well, that's not so, bad.
It was such an affront to width and angle.
I mean, I completely agree with you and don't have a good answer for why I should get excited about this PGA. Like, and I almost think like if Ricky or Rory or some big name wins it, it's like it should count as like a WGC win or something. I don't have a good answer for you. I completely agree. I'm not too amped about it.
Like, I think that it's Belle Reve is almost so offensive that it's intriguing to me in one way. Tonight I found out that when they did their most recent renovations, they put brown dye in the cement mix so that the cart paths were brown and they were more aesthetically pleasing.
Pragmatic.
That's how you want to spend your maintenance budget.
Yeah,
carpet aesthetics.
It's it shouldn't be a major. It should not be a major championship this year. Like,
I think it was Will Bardwell. Somebody was like, "Can we talk about like the air ball of not just the going there, but PGA having that 100th there?" Like, yeah. RNA like threw off the schedule a little bit so the 150th in 2021 could specifically be at St. Andrews. What, like, they like bumped St. Andrews back a year? What? It's the 100th PGA. It's your 100th championship. Like, what happened? Who didn't get the memo? Like, that makes it extra, I don't know, puzzling. That you're supposed to, like, celebrate your organization and your championship, you know, even in an extra way. And you're going to Bellarine, so.
Yeah, I mean, it's the closest major championship to me, and I'm really having a tough time getting myself to go. I don't know if I can go down there.
Well, the PGA, I feel like they're putting the stake in the ground on some better places, just not this year. Is that wrong? Am I mistaken?
I don't know. They're booked till like 2030. With venues. And like, I don't know. I think that
they're always juggling the whole Ryder Cup thing. All these clubs trying to get right.
You know, that's another thing. I got this for my like don't like article I've been working on that really grinds my gears is like the European tour or the European Ryder Cup site.
Oh God, yeah.
Like we're watching this at Carnoustie and I'm like thinking I'm being like I was like literally thinking I'm like how cool would it be if a Ryder Cup was out at a course like this or like Birkdale or St. Andrews? Like, how amazing would a Ryder Cup be at St. Andrews? But no, we're going to Le Golf National and we were at the Belfry and the K Club and Celtic Manor. Like these courses that don't embody at all what the golf over there is like. They play them at the most Americanized golf courses in Europe.
Is there a stated rationale for that? Like, because it seems so deliberate that there's a reason for it. Like, it's not just like a anomaly.
Like, why can't it be at Royal County Down?
Is it for infrastructure? Like, what? Why? I don't like Glen Eagle.
I think that's a big part of it. Yeah.
Yeah, but if they're the British, if you can have the Open Championship at a place. I don't know. I know the Ryder Cup's a little different because you want everything's concentrated on like 3 and 4 holes at a time. But I just Glen Eagles seemed gross. I mean
the Ryder Cup venues in general just bother me.
Sure.
Like,
but it's different. It's not about the venue. I mean, it's a competition that stands on its own and venue-less can be, I don't know, as much as it bothers your particular area of expertise. It's an adversarial competition. It's not the player versus the course.
Speaking of the Ryder Cup, though, the teams are like absolutely stacked this year.
I've heard that.
It's many are saying. You guys want to do overrated, underrated?
Probably. It's past midnight here in Scotland.
All right, we'll get Sean out of here. All right, overrated, underrated. The coverage.
I think
I don't know if I'm qualified here because I watched a lot of the world feed in the media center. I have a lot of friends that work at Golf Channel, so I'm biased, but I generally like NBC and Golf Channel. The ground tracer thing was cool. I'm going to say it's become cool to knock the coverage, so I'm going to say underrated. And again, that's probably the same problem we ran into before with other controversial underrated overrated is that I'm tailoring it for our small circle of friends and stuff, but I'm gonna say coverage is underrated because I feel like a lot of people just knock it because that's the cool thing to do.
So I would say talking about the coverage and this question is extremely overrated, and I am as guilty of it as anyone. I fall into it I don't know. I've written it a few times over the years. I just think like, I'm as guilty as anyone. I tweet about it too much. Just talking about the coverage is jump the shark. It's overrated. It's annoying. There's something really bad, then go ahead. If, you know, somebody's being a particularly big idiot or said something really stupid, go for it. But I just think like, we talk like no one cares. No one. People just tune in to watch Tiger. Like I know no one's trying to see like, you know, the amateur from whatever. It's just
Sam Locke.
What?
Sam Locke.
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess like it gets to us a little bit too much, but and we do want to see some of the like lesser story, you know, more random and I don't know, off the radar stories. But just talking about the coverage is exhausting. I've been done with it for a while. I've written it over the years. I think it's like even worse now.
I think golf is actually like probably the hardest thing to televise and of any sport because it's happened.
Definitely.
There's all these players in different spots across like every other sport is like, there's one place that the game is being played and a focal right. point of the action. Whereas golf, like, you know, you're all over the place all the time. So I think
also,
yeah, go ahead.
I saw some talk on Twitter about we should have commercial free broadcasts of majors. And I was like, guys, like what fantasy world are we living in? Like you got to pay the bills. You paid billions for these broadcast rights or millions. You got to recoup that somehow.
Yeah. I mean, the Masters is an anomaly.
Yeah.
It's just like people want all these articles for free and then, you know, expect deep reported investigations just happen. I don't know. It's, yeah. Twitter's just a place to complain, so it's not really surprising.
Hey, was Bryson's outfit on Saturday the best outfit of the week?
It made me feel good for getting up at an hour that I really didn't need to on Saturday. Very little was happening. For some reason, I was down on my couch in front of the TV at 5 a.m. or whatever it was, 4:30. And I look at the screen. I'm like, what the hell? What is going on? You look like some, like, I don't know, Slavic, like, gangster or, I don't know, or like an old Italian guy, you know, the outfit of an old Italian. It paid off for me to, you know, it was worth getting up early to see that. And it, of course, you know, it's all this newfangled technology. It just, the look from afar with like the all white shoes and the white, you know, Hogan cap with the shiny gray jumpsuit was just absurd. It wasn't intended. They want him to look slick and, you know, like he's wearing pieces of technology, not some fashion statement, but it was fantastic.
It was straight out of The Sopranos. That outfit. Yeah. I've seen that look many times. You know, there's six seasons of it.
I got to be honest, Brendan had a great week of tweeting. It was strong this week.
Hall of Fame week.
Yeah, I think overrated, underrated Brendan, I think, right?
I think his tweets are the bar.
They're funny without being just, it's so easy just to like rip on guys and try to get engagements that way. But like, they're funny without just being controversial or like without being like just mean. Like it's really easy to get people fired up on Twitter and just, you know, pick some player you don't like and just harp on them and ignite the masses against them and get it going that way. But like, they're funny while being intelligent without just being like, just mean for the sake of being mean. Like they're clever. I don't know. I think underrated Brendan.
I think your like retweet, like per tweet percentage is like better than anybody on the internet.
Yeah.
Shut up. I'm blushing over here.
Yeah. Gosh.
Just take what the course gives me.
Yeah. All right.
And so that Bryson tweet was definitely, I mean, that was the example of the week, but there's definitely more than that. Where that came from.
Overrated, underrated, out of bounds.
Overrated. It's why? I don't know.
I think it's I think it's underrated as is that the most brutal penalty in golf?
Yeah.
It's sure. So arbitrary. Like, there's so many things that are marked. Like, okay, number one at Carnoustie, the Barry Byrne runs down the left side kind of early off the tee. You have to hit a snipe hook to get it in there. But it's OB on the first hole. But it's the Barry Byrne. But, like, so on the first hole, if you hit it left into the burn, it's OB. On 18, if you hit it left into the burn, it's a hazard. Like, it's so arbitrary with OB sometimes. I don't know. And the penalty is so much worse than any other penalty in golf, really. It's overrated. I mean, I feel like also, though, we can't change it because then I feel like all scoring records almost are rendered obsolete, because if you take away OB and make everything a hazard, like, it's a huge thing you've changed in the game. And it's almost like raising the pitcher's mound or lowering it, or like changing the height of basketball rims in basketball. Maybe not that drastic, but I don't know. I don't understand OB. It's so arbitrary when something is OB versus marked as hazard.
That was the end of Ricky's championship.
OB should be off the property. Like, if you hit on the train tracks, that's OB. If you hit it slightly left into like a backyard where you could maybe play it, that should be a hazard.
But wasn't that the case?
Isn't that off the property?
Yeah.
All right. True. But
wasn't that the case this week? It was like the property was literally constrained. Like, that's where the property ended. No,
left of one into the Barry Byrne, like, there's plenty of property there. There's no reason that left of one in the Barry Byrne should have been anything besides a hazard. Like, literally, if you just hit it off the grass into the burn, so if your ball was sitting in the water on one, you were out of bounds. But you were in water, which is 99% of the time a hazard.
You know, yeah. I think it's underrated. I hate it. I think it. Yeah. I hate so many things about it. But, like, for example, that six hole wouldn't be as brilliant if it was a hazard down the left as sure. It is with honest, out of bounds. Like, they were people were terrified of hitting the ball left, and they just kept sailing them right and making sixes without, you know, going in any hazard on a par five. When do you ever see that?
It's as menacing as it gets. As menacing as the hazard, I think, right?
Oh, it's terrible.
I gotta be honest, Hogan's Alley is wider than I thought it was gonna be. I was a little bit disappointed.
Yeah, it's wider, but that out of bounds makes it like when you're trying to hit that tee shot as a like a in a tournament, it's absolutely terrifying. You like can't get yourself to hit it over there.
Also, underrated aspect of it, the ground slopes right to left. So it slopes towards the OB. So you've got to like hit a cut in there. No, I wouldn't take that line.
I mean,
it was wider than I thought it was going to be.
Ended Ricky's championship, right? I mean, he pumped one out OB and then got spooked mentally and shot one way right. And then he made it.
You know, not to go back to Belle Reve, but just that hole, the six hole.
Back to Belle Reve.
The six hole at Carnoustie, like, I look at that, and just Carnoustie in general, Chicago golf, like, what they do well is so simple. I don't understand how something like Belle Reve happened. Like, good golf architecture is so simple.
Hey, can you give us, like, the 60-second skinny on Belle Reve? Yeah, give us a little taste of why it's so... It's just, why it's so offensive? What's happened there at certain holes, or what's wrong?
It's just narrow fairways, long, and then it's just bunkers on both sides. You know, it's like, you know, hit it. It tells you where to hit everything. You know, like six at Carnoustie is great because you could hit it left and take that line, but they give you all this room to the right where it is like a delayed penalty. Where if I hit it over here, I might not be dead right now, but I'm actually dead. Unless I hit a perfect shot back. It's this delayed penalty. Like, everything at Belle Reve is just, you know, it's immediate, you know, ruling. Like, you're either good or you're bad. And I think where the brilliance in golf is when there's this gray. And when recovery is allowed. And when, you know, you're forced to take on the aggressive line, you know, and you might not know what the aggressive line is. And I think that's the thing why these Opens are so captivating, is because everybody has their different strategy. Like at Bellerive, the strategy is going to be exactly the same. But at Carnoustie, we saw guys, everybody was playing a different game plan. You know, Tiger was hitting irons off every tee. You know, like it allows for people, it forces people to think and execute, as opposed to Bellerive tells you the answer on every and just asks you to execute that answer. Hit it straight and far.
Width and angles.
Does that make sense?
Totally. I mean, I think, Carnoustie was great in that sense of, like, you had to take on the pop bunkers. You wanted the best angle.
And you could play safe, but, like, you're not going to play safe all round long and be at the top of the leaderboard.
No, Harrington said it great. Harrington was like, look, yeah, you can lay back short of the pop bunkers if you want here, but you're going to have 200-yard approaches almost all day long. And so you're not going to score. Which, but then at the same time, if you're like a 20 handicap and you're playing that course, like, it's great. You can roll it. You know, all great holes should be able to be played without a putter or with a putter, except for the 17th of Sawgrass, a great hole, but you can't play with a putter unless you get on the left. But no, I think that's the reason Carnoustie is great, I think, because someone had a great quote that some of the other links courses, like, you can kind of lay back from the pop bunkers, but you'll still have, like, if you lay back, you'll have, you know, 170 in, but if you kind of go for it, you'll have like 130 in. But that's like an 8-iron versus a 9-iron, 8-iron versus wedge, maybe. Whereas at Carnoustie, you lay back and you have like 200 in. If you go for it and push it, you have like 150 in. And now you're talking about like 6-iron versus like 9-iron. And that's a huge difference. So I think that was an interesting point of, like, at Carnoustie, you really have to push it unless you just want to be hitting long irons all day long.
All right, last overrated, underrated, Tiger.
I'm gonna say underrated, man. Like, I think, you know, we've heard him say it a lot every week of, like, you know, this time last year, I didn't think I'd be playing golf again. But honestly, like, this time last year, he never thought he'd play golf again. And the guy is contending in major championships. That swing he took on 10 out of that fairway bunker was like, I mean, there are very few people on the planet who can make that kind of a golf swing, let alone people on the planet who've had 4 back surgeries and can make that golf swing. And it's easy to get jaded with Tiger. Obviously, every time he gets in contention, the GIFs are just going to start flying. There's nothing I hate more than a tweet that has more exclamation points and GIFs than it does words. And that always happens when Tiger gets in contention. But at the same time, like, the guy literally, I mean, if you know what he was saying, like, he was bedridden and, like, had to use a golf club as a cane to walk out of his bed, and now is contending in major championships. You know, I know, like, it's not cool to gush about Tiger, but I mean, that's insane.
That shot he hit on 10 was like one of the greatest golf shots I've ever seen.
Oh, it was ridiculous to get it that high, but then also to move it that far forward
in that situation too. Like, hey, yeah. I mean, it's a shame.
There's burn there short of the green. You could hit that in the burn easily.
If he goes on to win that event, it's like into his top 15 shots of all time.
Oh, yeah.
That shot was unbelievable. And that's like, I think the thing about Tiger is, like, he regularly does things that you don't ever see anybody else do. He's way underrated. Is Brendan there?
I don't know.
I think he's gone.
Oh. I see him.
We might just have to call it. Brendan just left.
He left.
We'll get him in here real quick.
No, he's back.
You're back. Can you hear me? Yeah. Well, the last one, I don't know when we lost you, but the last one is...
I heard the whole thing.
Tiger Woods.
I heard it. I think... Yeah, like you guys are talking about a year ago. I wrote that Saturday, like a year ago. He was sending weird ass tweets about his Oakland Raiders pool table, and then he was shooting.
Was the fact that you remember that stuff is really like the key to your greatness. Like, I don't remember that at all, but That was a great tweet.
I mean, that was up there with whatever, Mac Daddy Santa for me. It's just like, wow, he should not have his account. What is the purpose of this? Like, he shouldn't have the keys. Why did he send? I just remember it in the moment. I agree with all that. I think, like this, like he says, it's a gift. Hashtag blessed. I'm way in on Tiger. I'm buying him, all that. I think we're kind of overrating. I don't know. I think based on the last 5 years of injuries and personal scandals and all that stuff and barely being able to walk kind of makes us a little more lenient. But he was having trouble closing before all that happened. He was having that trouble in 2013. He had that trouble at Muirfield, at Oak Hill. He was having that trouble. And he did again today. I know he led a major championship on the back nine on a Sunday. And I'm not like denigrating that. That's amazing. I'm just saying, and I thought golf, Brandel and Frank went into this better than anyone after the round, as we were all kind of, it was like it hit us some drug and we were on this high, and they kind of like brought it back down to earth for me. It was like, well, you know, he hit 5 and 6 fairways on every nine all week. On his back nine on Sunday, he hit 1 fairway. And they put up like a graphic about how many bogeys he has on Sunday back nine this year, whether it's, you know, pumping it out of bounds at Bay Hill or Quicken Loans, Wells Fargo, the players, you know, he put in the water at 17. Like, they're like the bogeys or doubles, bogeys are worse stats for his final round back nines, aren't great. So,
yeah, I mean, I thought Rory had a great quote. I mean, Rory said it basically that this Tiger does things that Tiger of 15 years ago did not do. Like, this Tiger is not infallible.
Like, so I don't want Tiger was scared to have my words twisted like we did with Xander.
How many times have you said that this podcast?
But I'm not trying to pour cold water on it. I just think like.
Wow, I know where this is going.
Everything that's happened in the last 5 years, we tend to kind of tend to just focus on the positive. I'm not sure that's necessarily the wrong thing to do, but there is.
Brendan Porat says Tiger is overrated.
Might be the headline of the the title of the podcast.
There is some. You know, we need to approach this with an equitability that, you know, the fanboys may not have. So.
Come for the architecture takes, stay for Brendan calling Tiger Woods overrated.
You won't believe it. You will not believe what Brendan Porath from SB Nation said about Tiger Woods.
Fortunately, it's such a small deal that I, you know, people don't aggregate my podcast.
Brendan Porath said what? Click here to find out.
And it's also at minute 75 of the podcast.
You'll never believe what Brendan Porath said about Tiger Woods.
We didn't get into blistering Tiger takes until the last 2 minutes of the pod.
All right, what do you guys got coming out about the Open? Brendan, are you published anything yet? Sean,
I'm on to publish all. I just did a quick jam on Frankie M this afternoon, and then started gathering things for the morning. Gonna have a thing on Tiger. Probably gonna have a thing on just a separate thing on like the holistic, the entire Sunday. So,
yeah, I wrote a Tiger piece. I thought it was pretty cool. I asked Xander, I forgot to ask him Saturday, but being a San Diego guy, if he was at the 2008 U.S. Open, and it was kind of cool. I thought he was there. He was at the 72nd hole, watching as like a 14-year-old when Tiger made that putt. And the last major he won, and then all of a sudden now, you know, Xander was being chased by Tiger. And I don't know, so that was cool. And so I wrote a Tiger piece on that. And his kids were there, which I thought was a cool moment. You can tell it really means a lot to him. I know it's kind of sentimental and easy to make fun of, but so I wrote Tiger today. I don't know what I have coming in. I'm very intrigued by Francesco. I wrote a stats post after after he won at Quicken, that he could have finished third to last in the field and he still would have won because he hit the ball so well, according to strokes gained. So I don't know. I'm very intrigued by Francesco. I feel like no one hits the ball like straighter like than he does. Like, he's the Italian Hogan. So
to try to do something with that, but
he didn't hit any foul balls, like any.
No, like no. And also, it's crazy too. People, no one mentioned Eduardo like at all today, but like Eduardo won the USAM at Marion, so the Molinaris now have a US amateur and a Clara Jug, which is insane. And like, it's crazy too because they don't look anything like brothers.
Yeah.
Eduardo's really skinny, and he like doesn't hit it very straight, and he's a scrambler, and he has an amazing short game. And Francesco forever couldn't putt, but just hit it dead straight like every time. Like, he's the Iron Italian, the Iron Byron. And it's so like, if you saw them play golf and saw them next to each other, you'd never know they were related, but they're both very good golfers.
What,
I don't know, very interesting.
The Molinari Slam might be the greatest record in golf.
I know.
You know, I'm writing an exhaustive piece about the I'm back moment of this weekend, which is Hunter Mahan tied first at Barbasol.
Oh, I'm so excited for that to tee off tomorrow.
I think they're teeing off right now. It's 7.
I thought it was post. No. It's 7. I don't know. Well, the leaderboard said they had an 8 p.m. tee time, which I assumed wasn't happening, and I assumed they're just
ZB texted during this pod that said I'm walking to the first tee.
Yeah, I'm very excited. That's a big story, I feel like. But yeah, I got nothing until Aronimink.
Yeah.
BMW Championship. Are you gonna be there? I know it's not in the Chicago area, but it's pretty woke.
I'm thinking about investing some resources and getting the lowdown, doing some stuff on for Marion or for Aronimink and Ridgewood.
Oh, and I'm playing Hickory Golf tomorrow. I'm woke. So other than that,
Hick Fever. You're gonna be you and Brandon Stone. That was one of the coolest moments of the week. That'll go.
I love Ryan. I love when you see professional golfers who love golf.
Yeah, it's so underrated, actually.
Yeah, it's like ZB. That's why we love him.
Too many guys, like, I don't know. I think that's one of the problems, though, is like, you know, is when it's your job, you lose what made you so great. You know, like, I don't know. It's tricky. But yeah, I agree. The guys that just can't get enough of golf are the best.
Yeah. Shout out ZB in minute 97 of this podcast.
Yeah. All right, guys. I'm calling it, unless you got anything else to say about the Open.
Oh, see you at Firestone and Bellevue.
Oh, I might go to Firestone, you know, just so I can put the final, you know, dirt on top of its grave as a PGA Tour site.
I gotta be honest, from a journalist standpoint, I love Firestone. It's like summer camp because you have the two other courses there. It's light till like 10 p.m. and so we would just go like take carts around and play golf until like 10. So I don't know. Selfishly, I love Firestone. It's one of my favorite events to go to.
I'm recording this from Northeast Ohio, so I'm gonna publish it and get out of town.
A great place.
All right, guys. Later.
All right.
Later.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.